begin whenever you wish.
Thank you, Judge. Judges, my name is Jennifer Newman. I am counsel for James Pettis today in an appeal from the Circuit Court, City of Richmond, on convictions of robbery and use of a firearm. I have had the difficult and uncomfortable position of arguing a matter that was argued before this court in the spring, and I feel the need to acknowledge that. The co-defendant is Mr. Pettis' wife, I believe, was here before this court on exactly the same issue, and this court found that there were no errors. That has been appealed to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has refused that petition. The exact issue was raised almost the same, although Mr. Hargett wrote that brief, but we would ask the court to consider, it was an unpublished opinion out of this court, so we would ask this court to consider ruling differently on behalf of Mr. Pettis, and that's the reason that I'm here today. Essentially, and I think this court has the ability to do that given some of the case law that I've reviewed, given it was an unpublished opinion, and although I know there's a case called Hill that I believe opposing counsel cited, it says there should be the same judgment. Obviously, that language, we're going to ask the court not to follow the should and to consider this on the merits itself. Essentially, the issue was a proposed jury instruction regarding the unexplained possession of stolen property. The argument at trial before the trial court was that the identifications of Mr. Pettis were not good, that they were none were made at the time of the incident. They were only made at trial and called into question these identifications. What was not disputed at trial was that Mr. Pettis, thereafter the robbery that same afternoon into the evening into the following morning, was in possession of the stolen credit cards and used the stolen credit cards with the assistance of Ms. Johnson, his wife. So that was not factually in dispute. So what was raised at the trial court was a proposed jury instruction that comes out of a case, and everyone agreed at trial court level. This court has agreed in Ms. Johnson's appeal. I believe opposing counsel has agreed it was a correct statement of the law, but whether or not the proposed jury instruction was appropriate is really the issue. And I think even now, after Johnson was decided, that this court has gone one step further to say that it even fit the facts of the case. So really what's at issue is, were the instructions that were given to the jury, were those sufficient? And should the proposed jury instruction have been granted? And that's where we stand today, and we would argue that it is not sufficient, solely for the purposes of the fact that, again, Mr. Pettis' argument at trial was, you caught me with the credit cards and using the credit cards, but you cannot prove that I'm the person who stole the credit cards, that I did not take them from the person of Mr. Pugh. And therefore, you cannot convict me of robbery. I believe it's instruction number 11 in the appendix. It's on page 169, I believe, is the instruction regarding the actual elements of the crime of robbery.
That'd be instruction 9?
Judge, I think it's instruction 9 for Ms. Johnson, but it's instruction 11.
It's instruction 11 for I think you're
Mr.
correct.
Mr. Pettis. And I don't know why there was a difference, but... I caught that as well this morning, Judge. So that instruction is the elements of the crime of robbery, and the earlier panel found that that instruction in and of itself was the instruction that encompassed the proposed jury instruction. We would argue that it does not, and we would argue essentially that...
Why would you, counsel, indicate that it would not fairly cover all of the elements?
Simply because what the proposed jury instruction speaks to is the unspoken language in the instruction 11.
It's based on Bazemore, and what Bazemore essentially indicates is that unexplained possession of property doesn't essentially make you guilty of robbery.
Correct.
But if you don't meet all of the elements as listed in Instruction 9, isn't that the same? Isn't it covered, I guess?
Judge, I think a lawyer can certainly say that, and I think the judge can certainly say that, but our argument would be that you're reading between the lines there, that these are the elements, and so you have to have these elements to prove robbery if you're following only Instruction 11, whereas the proposed jury instruction would have kind of fallen in between the lines of if the only thing that you believe the Commonwealth has proven is the unexplained possession of stolen property, you then cannot use that alone to find that they're guilty of robbery. And honestly, that's solely what our argument is, and for those reasons that we would ask that the court not agree with the earlier panel and not uphold these convictions. Thank you.
Ms. Tyson, come on up.
Good morning. May it please the court. This court should affirm the judgment in this case
because another panel of the court has already found compelling reasons to affirm. And I say that because, yes, it's true, because it's unpublished, you're not bound by the interpanel principle, but you are, you have the benefit of the reasoning of the earlier panel. And the reason that I cited the Hill case is because this is very similar.
But Hill's not necessarily applicable, is it? Hill, you have the same defendant essentially litigating the same facts. Here, there are two different appellants that potentially, well, some of the facts are the same and the instructions the same, but it's not necessarily in the same posture as Hill.
I would say that our case is in a stronger position than Hill, because in this case, it was a single trial. It was a single instruction that is at issue. It was a single ruling by the trial court. Everything is the same about this case other than the fact that it was a different defendant. But they were tried together in a single trial.
But just because somebody's tried together, just because you have co-defendants, doesn't mean that all of the evidence is applicable to each of the co-defendants. It can be that some evidence is only applicable to one. Isn't
that
fair to say?
Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
So would that not distinguish it from Hill?
No, it doesn't. I think that it doesn't, because what we're looking at is the appellate court's reasoning. And the appellate court's reasoning in Hill...
In fairness, I ought to tell you that I'm with the author of the other opinion that you're speaking
about
in Johnson.
I'm aware of that.
Sort of tiptoeing around it.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think it's important. I mean, we don't have a res judicata situation. We do not have the interpanel principle. But what we do have is the same issue is coming back before the court. And not only has the court, this court... ruled that the instruction was not required because the other instructions adequately covered it. But now, as of last Thursday, the Supreme Court has refused this petition. And, of course, I don't know what's going to happen to that case, whether they're going to petition for rehearing or what have you. But I do think it's significant that the case has gone up to the Supreme Court and that petition was refused. And the reason that this court correctly ruled last time is because the other instructions adequately covered the principle. And we've, of course, cited Payne, which cites Lawler, and more recently Houseair from the Virginia Supreme Court, that where the other instructions adequately instruct the jury, it is not error for the trial court to refuse to give another instruction, even if that instruction is a correct statement of the law. And that's what the trial court did in this case. The trial court in this case said the other instructions adequately cover this, and I'm not going to give this instruction. And I will say, with regard to Bazemore, that this trial court, I believe, said that he had read the Bazemore case four times. That's on page 141. The court very carefully considered that case, which was the authority that was presented to the court on why the instruction should be given. I want to look at not only instruction 11, because that is the binding instruction. And the court found quite correctly that if the jury found that all of these were proven, then they could convict Mr. Pettis. But the instruction clearly says if any of one of these have not been proven, you can't, beyond a reasonable doubt. And so instruction 11 is the most important instruction. But there are more. Instruction 1, which is on page 164, is the credibility instruction. The jury gets to decide whether this witness should be believed, Mr. Puat, who was the taxi driver. There was number 2, which is found on page 165, the presumption of innocence, the burden of proof, and no burden on the defendant to produce any evidence. So the jury has got this instruction. And they also have, frankly, number 5 is the circumstantial evidence instruction. And yes, part of the circumstantial evidence in this case was the use of the credit cards at the City Dogs, at the Camelot Inn, at these other places. But we also have circumstantial evidence of finding the weapon in the light fixture in the hotel, and we also have these defendants running away from the police. So even if you were looking at the use of the credit cards as circumstantial evidence, that's only part of the circumstantial evidence in this case. And finally, we have number 6, found on page 167, flight, and number 8, concert of action. So the jury was fully instructed without this proffered instruction with regard to all of the things that it needed to consider in order to decide whether Pettis, not Johnson, but Pettis, was guilty of robbery. And there was not a need for this duplicative instruction. I think it's also important to note that the trial judge said, well, you can argue this. And the reason I say that, and I know we cited Payne on our brief, that sometimes things that don't make it into the instruction are still fair game for robust summation. But I'll tell you that both parties in this case argued with regard to this fact. In closing argument, the defendant advised the jury that it was important for them to understand that just because the defendant had the credit cards and used the credit cards within some short period of time was not enough for them to find him guilty of robbery. And even the prosecutor, in her closing argument, 155-56, said, I'm not asking you to convict of robbery based on the possession of the cards within 45 minutes of the crime, but because the victim identified these two as the people who robbed him. So the jury had before them proper instructions, and then they heard in summation that this is not enough. And I realize that's not the instruction, but still, in the looking at the whole picture, as Walshaw says, we look at all of the instructions. We look at those instructions. We look at everything that happened at the trial, and the combination of these instructions adequately advised the jury what they should find. It adequately covered the issues for both the Commonwealth and the defendant. And the trial court did not err, it did not abuse its discretion in denying this instruction, which was subsumed and really covered by the instructions that were given in the case. This was a victim identification case. The defendant argued that the victim had improperly identified him. These instructions dealt with that issue as well. The court did not err in declining to give this instruction, and we would urge the court to affirm, as it did in the other case, that the issues are the same, and the judgment should be the same. We would urge the court to affirm.
Thank you.
Judges, very briefly, I appreciate opposing counsel's argument regarding closing argument. I would just say that obviously there's a need for jury instructions, and we don't rely solely on closing argument. And so the fact that both counsel were able to argue their position of the case in closing argument, I don't think should be the deciding factor as to whether or not the proposed jury instruction encompassed something that was not encompassed in the other instructions. I also appreciate the trial judges seemed like quite serious deliberation about Bazemore. And I think, frankly, that the defense counsel argued Bazemore as you must use this jury instruction. And that's not what Bazemore said, and so it's certainly not what I raised on my brief either. And I think that's the reason why the trial court took so much time in rereading Bazemore and commenting on it. I've read it multiple times, and I just don't think that it says that because this is a correct statement of the law, I have to use it. And the have to use it part was the part that the trial court really got hung up on. And so, again, it's our argument that when you read that instruction, the mere unexplained possession of stolen property by the defendant without more is not sufficient evidence to support a conviction of robbery, but is merely one circumstance that may be considered. If you believe from the evidence that the defendant had in his possession property that was the subject of the robbery, but you believe that the evidence as a whole fails to show beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was one of those perpetrating the robbery, then you cannot find the defendant guilty of robbery. It highlights the facts of the case. It highlights what the defense argued. It is not exactly the same language as in the finding instruction. And so that's our argument, is that finding instruction is legal terminology that obviously juries across this Commonwealth have used for years, but it doesn't necessarily say exactly this. And so when we're instructing a jury, I would not be able to make this argument if it were a bench, but if when we're instructing a jury, if this is a correct statement of the law, if the argument at trial is there was no identification at the time of the event, there was only the identification at trial, and we don't believe it was a reliable identification, we don't contest that he was in possession of stolen property, but we want to highlight that the law says that that alone is not enough. I think it's a valid instruction. We would argue that the trial court did abuse its discretion in not granting it.
Thank you. We'll come